Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and thanks for downloading this episode. My guest this week is actress, writer, and producer Katie Boland, whom you may have noticed as Clarissa on Rain, or playing a scene with Joaquin Phoenix in The Master, or in literally dozens of other things. She'll be at the Toronto International Film Festival later this week with two projects. One's a short film called Boxing, which she produced, and another is Robert Boudreau's Born to be Blue, where she has a supporting role opposite Ethan Hawke's Chet Baker. Katie picked Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Michel Gondry and Charlie Kaufman's magnificent 2004 romance, the one where Jim Carrey has ex-girlfriend Kate Winslet erased from his memory, only to find himself fighting the process and experiencing their courtship over and over from an increasingly splintered perspective. You've seen that, right? It's amazing. It's tragic and funny and wrenching and just so goddamn beautiful. But I'll let Katie do most of the talking. This is someone else's movie.
I vividly remember the first time I saw it, which is strange because I have no other memories of the first time I saw any other movies, but for some reason Eternal Sunshine has always stuck in my mind. I was 15 and I saw it with my best friend Ben, and we are still best friends.
Aww.
I know. And we were not normal teenagers. Like, we would go out to see movies and like for sushi all the time and then to talk about the movie after we didn't like get drunk or go to parties. And I remember it was the first movie I saw that I felt like completely immersed in and also completely like understood something about me. And I remember afterwards, like, the world just felt like a completely different place. And so I don't know why it spoke to me so much as a 16-year-old, because I like had never been in love and like never even had sex at that point. Whereas now when I see it 10 years later, it has so many other layers once your heart has been broken or once you've tried to make it work with somebody. And
yeah.
I just have one memory during the movie. So Ben and I were sitting and we were sharing popcorn. And then the woman in front of us, like, turned around and yelled at me. She was like, "Stop kicking my chair." And then Ben and I were like, "We're not." It was so weird. We don't know, like, what she was feeling. But we still laugh about that to this day. Yeah, Eternal Sunshine is still something that, like, he and I connect on. And it's honestly a movie that I think about, like, almost every day, which is weird that it had such an impact on me. But I truly think it's a masterpiece.
I agree. I put it on my list of the 10 best of the decade when I had to do that thing, which was narrowed down.
Oh, that's hard for you.
There was like 90. I think there were 90 to 98 titles. I ended up running most of them on my blog, just as the offcuts to show other people, look, this is how much I had to deal with. And it was a really good decade.
It actually was. It was a phenomenal
decade.
Yeah.
But Eternal Sun, there's something so powerful about it. There's something so beautiful about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something really special about seeing Jim Carrey in that tiny little window of his career where I don't even know what happened. He felt like he was willing to be used by filmmakers that he trusted. And sometimes it paid off and sometimes it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives the director the performance the director asks for.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, Gondry just gets it. Like, he gets
which
something
is interesting because I read that they really didn't get along.
Really?
Like, they almost came to blows during filming, which I find, I was like, oh, that shocks me, because I think it is exactly what you're saying. Like, he gave himself so much to that character and is so vulnerable.
Mm.
But I think the way that Gondry makes films too is he's like, you never have a mark. They never had marks, so the camera just had to follow them, and they were allowed to improvise a fair amount. And I think that can be frustrating as an actor, because you're like, what the fuck is going on a lot of the time. But I think that's why, especially Jim Carrey's performance, is just so different and so remarkable. I wonder, too, maybe that's what he's actually like in real life. I was like, I feel like I'm seeing, like, a real human being here, where I don't always feel that way with his performances.
Yeah. I've interviewed him a couple of times over the decades.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's been around forever, when you think about it.
The first time we met would have been after a stand-up thing in, like, the late 80s.
Right.
And that wasn't even a formal interview. That was just, we were at the same thing.
Yeah.
I had gone to see him
and
a couple of other people. And then we talked the year that Just for Laughs was in, the other one, Mark Breslin's People's Comedy Festival, which was his attempt to kind of steal Just for Laughs' thunder and do a summer festival in Toronto.
Right.
And Carrie emceed the big closing night show, and I got to talk to him for The Star, and this was the year before Ace Ventura, so it must have been 92. And he was, you know, he was doing In Living Color, he was very thoughtful,
right.
It was right after the Rodney King riots, so he was willing to discuss, like, as a comic, in all seriousness, that old
right,
joke
right,
from
right.
CTV,
yeah, yeah.
He was, we talked about working on a primarily black driven show in Los Angeles
during that time.
When everything goes to hell, how do you handle it? And he said, well, right. you just keep laughing. You make people laugh so they forget how mad they are. But then you remind them at the end why they were laughing. And it is because they were mad, and it becomes this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was fantastic and open and thoughtful and funny and a little bit manic, which I think was still kind of the sense that he had to be on all the time, or else people might not remember he was a comedian. And then now that he's become
a movie, like a serious Carrey, actor, movie star. Yeah,
yeah. Jim Carrey, the everything.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a lot more willing to be thoughtful in public, which I find really refreshing. That's just like he can be himself. Although the vaccine thing still bugs me. But but with this, I get the sense that he is absolutely giving reality.
Yeah.
Like, he is embracing the idea of being a proper human in a way that maybe he hadn't before. He played people, he played human beings and real characters. He'd already made Man on the Moon, and he'd already done The Majestic, where he plays, you know, a normal person, ostensibly, but the movie doesn't work and it's sentimental, and he gives that kind of overly syrupy thing to his performance. In Eternal Sunshine, he is a lost soul. Like, he's someone who is hurting all the time, and you really instantly feel that. Even the moment you see his face in the
first shot is, like, his really heartbroken, depressed face. And I think reality is a really interesting thing in this film, because it's so unreal in so many ways. Like, there's such a fantastical element and all the equipment that they use to screw with people's memories. But then it's also, like, the most real film ever emotionally.
Yeah.
Like, so I think it's interesting how it's, like, so mind-bending and so heartbreaking at the same time. And I don't know how he struck that balance. I think that that's a really difficult thing to do, because it's, like, crazy that you could damage your brain only in certain places and just erase one single person, even though I would kind of love to do that with a few people.
But that's the real thing, right? It's an impossibility that you instantly respond to.
Yeah.
It's like, the only thing I compare it to, and people look at me funny, is the opening of Time Cop,
I haven't seen that.
It's not very good. The terrible Jean Van Damme time travel movie that everyone loves because they grew up watching it on cable.
Right.
Opens with a scene where a scientist person simply says, "We have time travel. You can only go backwards. You can't go forwards. And this is how it works." And nowhere for the rest of the movie does anyone stop and go, "But how? And why?" And Eternal Sunshine basically does the same thing. Oh, this business is here. It already exists.
Yeah.
We're not even going to bother with it, and now we launch into a surrealistic and completely subjective depiction of what the process looks like. I think it's the only way to do it, because it's so crazy that if you did
get into the science and the actually complicated parts, people would be like, no, absolutely not.
Or you'd be there all day, and you'd have to introduce more characters, and the scientists would have to yell about how the Flibbergen wasn't working or something. I think the only other movie subsequent is Inception, which also just jams right along that idea that, no, it's real, it's happening, shut up, we're doing this right now, and then throws the effects at you.
Yeah.
And also uses the same kind of practical playfulness that Gondry does, and that always fascinates me. I'd love to talk to Nolan about this, because Inception is the opposite of Eternal Sunshine, in that it is so
very high-tech
and cold and dead emotionally, even though it's all about a lost love.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the movie that Christopher Nolan thought Eternal Sunshine should have been. Oh, no, I know how to do this. It's going to have an airplane, and it's got to have a city folding in on itself, and, ooh, a train. But what Gondry does is he makes it instantly human by rooting it in exactly what you said. And you're like, I wish I could do that.
Yeah.
Everyone, even just the thing that crushes me is the shot of the woman holding the dog stick.
Oh, my God. I know, when I was watching that again for this, I was like, that is so sad and so brilliant.
And Charlie Kaufman has had a dog. Like, that's what that tells me. There's no way you come up with that detail casually.
Yeah.
Because you'd have to be the most horrific sadist in the world.
I know.
My dog was still alive when I saw that. And that's just, there's that moment where you're just like, oh, right. Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's a movie that knows what emotion is.
Yeah.
And how you can turn it on and off, or you can turn it on at the flick of a switch, but you can't turn it off. And that's where the conflict comes from.
And even with these characters, and I think what I love too about Kaufman's work so much is all the sort of metaphysical questions that it asks. And I think this is the most grounded emotionally. I actually think he's at his best in this movie. I think this is his best, but how are we just our thoughts? So could you just erase those memories and then you could go on and be fine? Or is there always like a fallout and an after effect? Because there's all those other people that didn't get erased from that, that remember you. Like when she sees the neighbor and he's like, oh, hey, Clementine. She's like, what? Who the fuck is that?
Yeah.
So it's like, could I erase one of my ex-boyfriends? Or... and would they just be completely gone and I would feel better, like surgically erase them? Or would they always be a part of me no matter what, because they did have that effect on my life?
Yeah. Well, that's the whole argument about memory, right?
Like, yeah.
You are not you from minute to minute. Your brain thinks you are.
Yeah.
That's where your personality comes in. And it's absolutely the accumulation of bad decisions as much as good decisions mm-hmm. that make us who we are. I mean, mm-hmm. your regrets are why you don't hurt people mm-hmm. again the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Or... why you think twice before doing something that might be bad. Mm-hmm. I think that's what conscience is. Conscience mm-hmm. is memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's learned decency.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that is so marvelous about Kaufman's construction is that everyone else is acting very, very badly.
Everyone's actually awful when you think about it.
Joel is
like Mark Ruffalo. Terrible.
And Ruffalo and
Kirsten
Wood.
I feel bad for Kirsten Dunst's character, but
I think you're supposed to.
Yeah,
but what you see is that the people who are entrusted with literally changing another human being's mind
mm-hmm.
are just really irresponsible idiots.
Yeah,
for the most part,
or just like human beings.
Yeah, distracted and easily corrupted.
Yeah,
and mercenary and lazy and smoking.
Yeah.
Just the cigarettes are so great because clearly this is made by a Frenchman.
Yes.
Because in 2004, there really wasn't that much smoking going on anymore.
I know, there was an incredible amount of smoking in that film.
Yeah. And it's great. Like it also allows, I think on some level, it allows me to buy the unreality a bit more because mm-hmm. in a world where this is happening, maybe cigarettes aren't bad for you, or maybe they just never went out of vogue.
Mm-hmm.
But and really, I'm sure it's just Gondry going, look, if I'm on a set, there's going to be cigarettes because I'm going to need something in 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
As soon as I call cut, we're lighting up.
Yeah.
But the intensity of that, there's so much that feels real that the slide into surrealism is almost organic.
Yeah.
Like it's a reaction against how weird everything is, but it's also a complete expression of it.
Yes.
So how do you, at 16, you know, you presumably haven't seen that many movies like this. I mean, I saw it when I was in my 30s and I hadn't seen many.
Yeah.
How did it feel to experience that? I mean, you said it was intense, but... did you accept it right away? Were you resisting? Like, did you push against it?
I accepted it right away. And I remember it was like, I had a really visceral emotional reaction. And it's funny because I've seen it like tons of times, but I still cry every time. And I know I cried that first time. I know Ben was like, are you okay? Right. But so I remember, and I think that, that's because I think like, even if you haven't fallen in love or had your heart broken, there's something so human and like everyone knows what that feels like. And it's the same kind of for everybody.
Yeah.
So even though I had all those wonderful things to experience still in my life, it just affected me so much. And I also, Kate Winslet's character spoke to me so much. Like I felt a kinship to Clementine, and I don't know what it was, but she's one of my favorite characters ever on film. And I know it is Kate Winslet's favorite character she's ever played, but there's just something about that woman that stuck with me that I was like, I think I'm like her. I think I'm going to be like her. And I love her, even though when I rewatched it this morning, I was like, she's actually really destructive and really crazy and not actually very real.
Even though
she plays it in a really real way, she's actually like I was like, oh, she's actually like a very broad character.
Yeah, well, she has to play every version of herself that Joel sees.
Yes.
So she has to be everything.
Yeah.
She has to be idealized, and she has to be loathsome, and she has to be short and tempered, and she has to be cruel, and she has to be funny, and she has to be alive. And it's just this great way of seeing how people relate to one another.
Yeah.
Because even though... on one level, there's definitely a gender thing going on where the poor wounded man is remembering the awful ways his woman treated him.
Mm-hmm.
It's filtered through Winslet, who is such an able performer that she's mm-hmm. she allows Clementine to be real even when she's being unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still kind of stunned by that performance mm-hmm. because we really... like, we never see the real Clementine, ever, because when we meet her in the real world, she's already been altered.
Yes.
And then at the end, neither of them is the original.
Like
and this might not even be the first time this has happened, which I think
know.
Is so beautiful.
Yes.
And we can still see the way they're like their basic versions of their personalities connect to one another, we can still understand why it worked for them, even for a short time.
Yeah.
Which is so weird and beautiful, and I don't even know where you start to build a character like that.
Like, as an actor,
she must know who Clementine really is.
Yes.
And who she is to Joel.
Yeah.
But she never tells us. Like, we never know who the real Caroline is. We never see her at all.
Yeah. I know, you only... Yeah, it's interesting, because I thought to you today, I was like, what would the movie be like that was just Clementine's memories when she, that she was trying to erase? But it's interesting because there's so much, like, fragility and vulnerability in that character who is also so loud and aggressive, and I thought that she really... It was a really interesting balance that she struck. But yeah, I sort of feel like you see the real Clementine when she's listening to the recordings where Jim Carrey's character says, well, I know you fucked him because that's how you get people to like you. And you see, so the first time she sees that, it's like that huge reaction where she like leaves and then starts disappearing and she's really drunk. But the second time, I sort of feel like you saw the real person, at least for a split second, because you could see that that landed and was sort of true and her greatest nightmare, but also that she was able to kind of keep it together like a human being for a second there because someone else was watching her. But I think, that I could just like think about and watch that performance for probably ever and find different, like really moving parts of it. And that scene where my favorite scene in the whole movie is when she's under the covers and she says, do you think I'm pretty? And it's like, those are the moments that you have with a lover that are just like so vulnerable, where they see so much of yourself, and it doesn't matter if you hate them or never see them again. They had that version of you.
Right.
And so few people ever get it, but they had it. And that's, I guess, no matter what, like a special thing. And that's why I do think ultimately it's an optimistic movie, even though it's also like so brutal about relationships.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think the ending is I think it is really optimistic. And I think the ending is.
Yeah, I think so, too. Like, I want to believe they'll make it work this time. I don't know that they will, and maybe the idea is that they just infinitely do this. That this is their destiny.
Yeah.
To constantly, and maybe there'll be more time in between meetings, or less time, or more time in a relationship. Maybe, you know, this time they'll get through 3 years, and next time they'll get through four, and you can sort of incrementally perfect yourself for someone, which is what life is anyway, which is what a relationship is. You know, you're never, there's this, I can't remember who first said it, but it's this amazing theory, you know, like dating is lying, you're always presenting your best self, and then if you're lucky, you get to be the person that the person you love thinks you are.
Right.
Like, if you hit it right, and probably that won't happen.
Right.
Probably the person you love will find out who you really are.
Yeah.
And still love you, and that's nice too.
Uh-huh.
But the idea of relationships as improving yourself rather than improving the other person.
Yeah.
That's what this is somehow.
And yes.
I think like there's an understanding of intimacy. It's exactly what you were saying, is that it knows what it's like to be that honest.
Yeah.
And how painful it is.
Yeah.
And so the movie is showing you its heart, and it's like, there are moments where I almost can't look at it.
It's That's just the thing.
So
it just,
beautiful.
It's so beautiful, and it reminds you so... Or I don't know, maybe this is mine, but there's parts that just remind me so much of myself and like the relationships that I've been in. And it's like almost like, oh no, I don't want to remember. Or I do, but I do also want to remember what that's like. But I also, it's like, it's definitely painful to watch it in like an exquisite way.
Yeah.
But it's painful.
It's a good hurt. It's the, you know, it's finding the old album and pulling it out again. It is, it's nostalgia, right? Like, it's the whole idea of falling in love with the type of person that the movie makes you feel that you are. It's the same kind of relationship as with another human being, is the sort of relationship you have with the vibe of this film. And Gondry never did it again. Like, he's...
I know, I was going to say, his other films I don't like very much.
Yeah. I can kind of appreciate things about them.
Yeah.
Kaufman, I mean,
I loved her. Yeah, he's my favorite.
Well, Synecdoche. Is just...
I loved it, but I was... Actually, I did not like it when I was watching it, and then I thought about it so, so much after, so I was like, I guess I must have liked that, because I still think about that movie. So that was a good movie, actually.
Yeah, it's more of a puzzle box,
cerebral, I think. Yeah.
And still, in the end, rooted in this terror of death and mortality that Eternal Sunshine represents in a very different way, because it's about the death of love instead of the person. I think it would actually be worse to Kaufman to lose someone else than to lose himself, because if you lose yourself, it's over, presumably. Like, you just not.
Yeah.
And if you have to live in the shadow of a failed romance like Joel does, you will do anything to not feel that way anymore.
Yeah. I remember once I was talking to sort of an uncle figure of mine in my life, and he said, I had one lover who died and one who left me for someone else, and it was worse when he left me for someone else than, like, it was more grief.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that's true, because there's no finality to a breakup like that. The person is is kind of dead, but they're just still living in the world, and you're not a part of it.
They're just not yours anymore.
Yeah. So I think that that actually is kind of worse. And that is when you're in the real throes of that, like, you do want to erase them.
Sure.
Even the good memories. But then, like, when you really think about it, you're like, well, do I actually, is it so much a part of who I am now that would erasing it just change everything fundamentally? And knowing what I do now about heartbreak, would I do it all over again? Which I guess at the end of the movie, they're like, yes, this could be like the most awful ever, but I would try again. I would do it again. And I guess that's what's cool about being human, is it doesn't matter like how hurt you are, you will try again.
Yeah.
You want to.
You can choose not to learn.
Yeah.
Or you can choose to try something differently, but you still get to make the choice. You're drawn to it anyway. I mean, I guess that's the other thing too. How does it even work? People can sequester themselves away and still yearn for human contact or fall for somebody. And I guess that's how stalkers are made. People just become obsessed with a thing that isn't real, but that they want to have for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if Joel is doing this out of spite, you know, you erased me, I'm going to erase you.
Yeah.
We see that that isn't the right move. Like, the movie obviously knows that it's wrong, because he knows it's wrong and starts fighting against it, which is why the film exists. I mean, why the story is told and the direction it's told, and why it's so incredibly thrilling. The practical effects, the mirroring, the way the world comes apart, which are so simple, actually.
Yeah. It's just like turning lights out or like fucking with the sound a little bit.
And or tilting a mirror from one side to the other.
Yeah. And I would think, I was reading, there's one scene where Jim Carrey is in one outfit and then runs to the other side of the room and is in another and back and forth. And that's actually how they shot it. Like, he changed clothes while running. So I was like, think about how, I think it was like, it's stressful and difficult, John, took them forever. But think about that. That's like that's a really interesting choice, as opposed to just the normal way you would do it, which is special effects or cut. And then,
yeah, and in a weird way, it's honest. You know, I think that's what it is about the film. It's that it mirrors the emotional honesty with a sort of a physical honesty, and that everything you're seeing is being, or almost everything is being achieved in camera and delivered to us truthfully, even though it's a fiction and a fabrication and a lie. It's showing us something that you probably wouldn't get any other way than by making it by hand. And as much as that has sort of undermined Gondry's subsequent films, the thing Mood Indigo, that thing he did with Bernal, and The Science of Sleep, which also has Bernal, where you just want to strangle the adorability out of it.
Yeah.
And Be Kind Rewind was actually the first movie I reviewed for Now when I got the gig.
Oh, cool.
And I felt terrible about it because I didn't like it.
Right.
I get it.
I really wanted to like this. Yeah.
Of all the, I have to be mean to this movie that's made by the guy who made one of my absolute favorite films in the last few years. And, well, here we go, folks. This is what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to be brutally honest, I guess. But those films don't have Kaufman,
who is just, like, so wretchedly human. Like, that you just, it's not adorable at all. You're like, that is the worst parts of being, almost all his movies are kind of about, like, the really uncomfortable, awful parts of being alive, as well as, like, the flip side beautiful, but...
Sure, but I think that's it, right? You can't understand profound joy unless you've watched Philip Seymour Hoffman look at his own bowel movement, you know, like, at the beginning of Synecdoche. And I'm not saying that this is a prescription for everyone to be happy. Perfectly fine.
You guys heard it here first.
Yeah. We have to all start our day every day with Synecdoche, New York. It's something about there, like, he has an understanding of, the most, not unpleasant exactly, but necessary, I think.
Yeah.
Like, the most necessary functions of humans.
Mm-hmm.
It's why Clementine has to be mean to Joel in the way that she is.
Mm-hmm.
It's why Joel has to be mean to Clementine in the way that he is, and why the only word that works is mean, because it's childish and raw, and it doesn't suit an adult's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to understand that that's how they're relating to one another. They're, mm-hmm. they're just on that level of spite and anger and lashing out mm-hmm. because they invested
still love
so
each other
much
so
each
much.
Other.
Yeah. yeah.
They invested so much of themselves in each other. And it is just, like, that's why it hurts, I think. The scene yeah. where she takes care of him as a child and the scene where yeah. he imagines her as a kid. And
yeah, oh, I always cry at that scene. I can cry thinking about it. Yeah, it's really beautiful. And, like, really just, it's, yeah, it's just true. Because then you, like, I don't know, I go back and then I think about my ex-boyfriends and what were they like when they were kids and would we have gotten along? And then it's just like, oh, and look at us now, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But I think it's such a human curiosity, too, to be, I had to wonder, how are you remembered? And I think Clementine says at one point, near the end, or maybe when they're saying goodbye to each other, like, remember me, like, try your best, and let's make up a goodbye. At least let's try to have a goodbye this time or something. I don't think that's exactly it. Mm. But I think that's so human to be like, how do you remember me? Or what was your take on that night? Or is there any sort of crossover? Or do you think about me at all? You know, it's yeah. all, like, so, all these questions that we have, I think that we feel like we can't ask, but then if we lived in that world, we could just get people erased and then we'd have all the answers.
Right. It makes you really glad, or it makes me really glad that they didn't come up with an entire alt universe explanation for everything, that there is no scene where, you know, a character writes a note to himself, because that's a different movie. That's
yeah.
a different that's a thriller. Or it's mm-hmm. it's a drama that goes in a different direction. This is so completely and totally a love story.
Yeah.
Even though that love is over by the time the movie starts. Mm-hmm. It's about rediscovering and oh, the flood of emotion that comes with reconsideration and regret. That,
yeah.
That's the stuff that never goes away.
Yeah.
So, obviously, you've been an evangelist for this film ever since you've seen it.
yeah, yeah.
You forced it on people. And do other people get it? Do other people...
I do think it's one of those rare movies that is pretty universal. Like, I don't meet very many people that don't like this movie. But it is, I do talk about it often, and it is a movie that I force on people, absolutely.
Yeah.
yeah.
Good.
But it's always fun to watch it with a new person or to have a conversation about it, because I also think it means a lot of different things to different people. Like, people, I think, that are less romantic than me can take other things from it than I do.
Okay. I mean, how have people, do other people...
Remember I talked to one friend and it was an interesting conversation, but he thought it was a commentary on pharmaceuticals in our society and how we all are trying to, or I guess society encourages us to numb our feelings completely or to just try to forget things that are bad or that cause us pain. And I thought that was interesting. I was like, oh yeah, I could see that. Like, I do think it's sort of talking about how we do try to take the easy way out a lot in our society, or that that is what's most acceptable.
I had never thought about that. That's
yeah.
a really interesting interpretation, and it's a totally valid read.
Yeah.
I
wonder what Ben, my friend, I need to call him after this and be like, yo, do you still think about Eternal Sunshine? And what do you think about it? And do you remember that lady from the movie theater? But
I wonder what it was. Maybe she was forgetting the time that she'd been kicked before and it suddenly brought it back as a repressed memory or something.
Yeah. All I know is we were 16 and we thought it was the funniest thing that had ever happened to us. But, and I remember after, I don't know if you might still get this feeling after movies, but when you walk outside and you sort of still feel like you're in the movie and the world feels like more cinematic and you're walking home like as one of the characters. And I remember that is 100% what happened.
Yeah.
The whole world looked just like a little bit bluer. Like, oh. You know, the whole movie has like these blue tones. And
that's
like
great.
Really beige.
I'll find myself carrying the emotional
yeah.
vibe out, but very rarely just sort of actually like feeling altered by a film.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this movie, and this would have been the spring of 2004.
Yeah.
So Kate and I weren't married yet, but we were already living together, but she didn't see it with me. I saw it at a 10 a.m. press screening somewhere
right.
on a Friday morning probably. And she was still working her day job. So she was out and I had to just sit with it. Alone
wow.
for several hours because I really didn't feel like talking to anybody else
mm-hmm.
but her
wow.
after I saw it. And then I remember she never saw it theatrically. We ended up watching it on disc at home. She managed to miss the window somehow.
Right.
She was working a 5-day a week job and we were the wedding was pretty small, but we were working.
Yeah,
we
I mean, that's a big,
well
big deal.
That. Yeah, yeah. Sitting all, it was nothing. But there was so much going on that she never saw it theatrically. So then we ended up watching it again. Maybe a year later, she finally saw it, and I was just sort of sitting there going,
right? Yeah.
And she, I think she agreed. Yeah. But it's one of those films that you kind of need to have in you before you can even start to talk about it. It would be very difficult. It was very difficult for me to describe it.
To explain it.
To write about it. Mm-hmm. And I did it a couple of times. I wrote about it for Metro. I wrote a little 300-word review. Right. For the theatrical release, and then when the DVD came out, I actually got more space.
Right.
And there's no way to just be clinical about it. You have to say, this is how I feel about it, because
right.
otherwise, how will people even understand?
Like, yeah.
It's a profound emotional experience that just happens to be made up of pictures and noises.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, there are little hints and clues to how deeply Kaufman feels it, and Gondry is just doing his absolute best to realize what that mm-hmm. is. And I know that the nature of the big effects numbers, you know, mm-hmm. things disappearing and breaking down and literally crumbling,
mm-hmm.
was figured out on the fly for the most part, they said.
Right.
That Kaufman could describe something but didn't know how it was going to happen.
Right.
And Gondry built it, and that's how they shot it.
I'd be so curious to read the script. I actually should try to look for that online.
It must be out there, yeah.
Yeah, it must be so interesting, like, how all those things are described.
I almost don't want to.
I know, because then you might be like, oh, it's changed forever. But did you see the other movie that they made together, Human Nature?
Yeah.
Was it good?
I didn't like it.
I haven't seen it, but I was like, oh, this movie must be bad. I liked it.
There are ideas in it that are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also so, where Eternal Sunshine is not, Human Nature is insufferably fanciful. Patricia Arquette plays a woman who's completely covered with hair and has to go live in the jungle by herself like a savage. Meanwhile, Reese Ifans has been raised in the wild reared on his own, and so he barely understands human interaction. And also Tim Robbins is trying to teach mice table manners. And
so it's just like the weirdest parts of both those filmmakers.
It feels like, yeah, what if this was a thing? And what if we did this? And the movie doesn't seem to... Well, Gondry wasn't being given his head yet. He was being controlled. I think he was sat on very tightly either by the budget or by the studio as he was making it.
Right.
So it isn't... It doesn't go as big as it could be. And there's nothing as baroque and weird as the imagery in Sunshine.
Hmm.
So it's all very flat and simple, and there's a framing device that has Robin's character trying to explain his situation and how things have happened in flash forward to an unseen authority figure, and that doesn't work at all. So you're just constantly aware that the movie is almost engaging with what it wants to get to, but the subtext never becomes readable. It's just these jumble of ideas that keep flying past you so quickly that you can't make head or tail of it. And some of the ideas, when realized on screen, just look dumb.
Like,
they just don't work.
Right.
And
so how did they get it so right in this movie? I don't know.
I think the alchemy is down to Gondry using his tricks. Like,
right.
Because
he was allowed to do a little bit more.
Yeah. Human Nature is his most straight, conventional realization of a story. The story itself is nuts, but he is treating it with as much realism and flat sort of TV lighting and two-dimensional shooting as possible. Eternal Sunshine, and then The Science of Sleep, and even Mood Indigo are fanciful, and Be Kind Rewind plays with, you know, it plays with texture and the video reenactments and all that, and it exists on its own level of kind of twee interactivity.
Mm-hmm.
These are films that are at least telling you visually that they're nuts, that things are going on that you might have to think through and work with, or just embrace, because, hey, look, Jim Carrey is a normal-sized person in a giant sink.
Yeah.
You know what this means.
Like,
on some level, your brain can tell you how to interpret this.
Yeah.
Whereas in Human Nature, there is no engagement with that whatsoever. Things are just there.
Right.
And they just flop around, basically. You have to figure out what they mean. I don't know how it worked. I don't know how they managed to understand each other. Maybe it's just that Focus Features really, really trusted Gondry on the pitch. And
right.
was like, okay, go
and
for
like,
it.
And, like, just let him do what he wanted to do.
Yeah. And Carrey was still, like, a huge
box office draw. He was a huge star. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, his star is probably just as big now if he makes another Ace Ventura movie, but,
yeah.
you know, it's dimmed since 10 years ago, but he was huge. Winslet was already sort of accepted as a major force,
yeah.
I think. Although this was her first...
I think this was, she said in something that I read that this was her first, that she was really honored and flattered that Gondry wanted her because she was always doing like corset dramas. And this is the first time she could play someone kind of like herself. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting. I wonder how much they were involved in the movie, like ultimately what they said. And the, I mean, it's very much a Charlie Kaufman movie. Like you can tell that it's his script. Like even if no one told me, I'd be like, this is a Charlie Kaufman movie for sure. But I wonder like if it was how collaborative it was or, because there's so many, I almost feel like everyone's at their best. And whenever that happens, I'm like, what was the alchemy here? How was this allowed to be so good?
Yeah. And it's, I think it comes down to trust. I think it comes down to everybody just doing what they feel is right in the moment for their characters and hoping and knowing that the director's going to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you could go terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Just one mannered performance, one, I mean, just like if Elijah Wood had been a hair twitchier.
Yes.
Because he's already pretty,
he's already so creepy.
Right?
Yes.
But I think like he knows exactly how creepy he can be.
Yeah. And you do still kind of understand why he did that. Because you're like, oh, he's really lonely and she's really like captivating. And he's doing exactly like the speech that she gives, which is making her like a projection when she's just like a fucked up girl who wants her own peace of mind.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, and I was like, oh, I, as much as I could hate this Elijah Wood subplot, I do like it. I still think he's really good in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible for us to understand that the character is disturbed, but not unredeemable, I guess, or just to have empathy with someone. Maybe it's that simple. This comes up a lot in movies that people bring to the show, because I think there's something that people respond to very, very profoundly. About a film that leaves you the room to understand all the characters, that doesn't immediately caricature or judge people. It's really, you know, it's really easy to hate a character that the movie wants you to hate.
Yeah.
But it's much more compelling and problematic and the kind of thing that stays with you if you can almost understand why someone does a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't even hate Tom Wilkinson in this, even though I would say he's probably the villain. I understand
if there is one,
like I understand why he has created this service for people and why he's having an affair.
Mm-hmm.
Like I kind of think he and Kirsten Dunst really love each other, and it's sad that they can't be together in a way.
Yeah. Well, it's again, people, what is it? The nature, the primal engine of comedy is people wanting something that's just out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
And the primal nature of drama is people getting the thing they want and realizing that they don't necessarily need it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, Virginia Woolf versus, what's a good example? Palm Beach Story. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with values that you don't necessarily share with the characters, but you can understand why they do the things they do. And that's what makes the stuff last. It's Transformers movies where it's all just digital noise and software fighting software and Shia LaBeouf running around yelling Optimus. Well, I mean, yeah, it's sort of cool to watch toys fight each other on a giant scale in IMAX, and certainly there are audiences that go for that, but they don't linger. I don't think anyone will ever say, oh, my favorite Transformers movie is.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just say, oh, the one I can watch the most, or the one I can stand.
Yeah.
The one that, you know, touches me, that's never going to come up. There's a difference, unless it's one of those stories where, you know, show me on Bumblebee where they touched you.
Right.
That's... Now I feel
dark, Norm, yeah, but I loved it.
I just, there's something bad about those movies. but yeah, right. I mean, this is the Jim Carrey movie that will introduce people to art, like to genuine cinema.
I think that is what this movie did for me. This was like the first time I think I was introduced to genuine art in cinema, and that it like impacted and changed me forever. So I think this was the first, yeah, that's what it did for me, which I didn't realize till right now. But that's a big deal for a movie to do that for someone.
Yeah, so going in, what was your impression? Did you know it was like more serious than the average Jim Carrey?
No, I was like, what a weird title. I remember thinking that. But I remember Ben was like, no, yo, like it got like really good reviews. Like we have to go see it. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever. I thought it was so weird, so weird. Even the first 10 minutes of it, or you know, until he's crying. So when you see them, we think it's for the first time, but actually meet for the second time.
Right.
I was like, this is so weird. This movie is so weird. And then when it cuts to the rain and him crying, you're like, oh, this is great. Actually, I think that's when it really got me.
Yeah. There was I saw it back at the point where, and I'm pretty sure it doesn't start with titles, right? Like it just,
no, it just starts. Yeah.
So there was at the time I had seen enough movies screwed up by projection errors. Mm-hmm. that I was, I'm always the guy who's hyper aware, hyper alert.
Because you have to see so many movies.
Yeah. And you just, you know, like you learn to know if the film, the frame isn't right. Or mm-hmm. in the olden days, when this was an issue with celluloid, you know, like prints could be lined up improperly or they could be assembled wrong and you get the real three instead of real two.
Yeah.
Dropped in. And the way Eternal Sunshine starts, like if it hadn't had a distributor's logo at the beginning, I think I would have panicked.
Absolutely.
Because you're thrown into it.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, you're at the wrong end of the story intentionally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it is incredibly disorienting. And given that I was not that high on Gondry at the time,
right?
I was sort of braced for, oh my God, this is going to be insufferable.
Yeah.
And then in seconds, it finds its tone. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing. And
I now think watching it's orange sweatshirt and like her hair dye. I think there's something about that where you're just like, I'm captivated now.
Right.
She was wearing wigs through the whole movie.
You color your hair that much, it'll just,
I thought it was
off,
like,
right?
You know those, like, the spray dye that, like, I used to do a lot when I was a kid? That's what I thought it was. Oh. But it's a wig. Like, several wigs.
The wig makes sense, though. I mean,
great
just
wigs,
of,
though.
If you'd have to shoot over multiple days.
Yes,
multiple
you couldn't possibly,
days,
yeah.
But, yeah, it's one of those things where I don't even, like, the practicality of it, I don't even want to think about
how
much work must have gone into it.
I know.
But it makes her so distinct, and it's a great way of color coding for us suddenly,
yes,
to tell us where
happening.
We are in
yeah.
time, as opposed to something like, you know, when Ramona Flowers does it in Scott Pilgrim, she just changes her hair color every couple of weeks and
yeah.
it's a character point,
yeah.
which is also great, but the movie moves in a linear
yeah.
progression, so it's just like, oh, now it's pink. That's
yeah.
all. Like, that's all it is. It's just proof that Mary Elizabeth Winstead looks fantastic in
all hair colors,
any hair color.
Very beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. It's, and I think Wright has said that it was a straight line towards that the style of the color was a nod to Eternal Sunshine.
Mm.
I'm sure I read that somewhere.
I believe that.
But it's,
I believe you that's
yeah.
true.
He's an omnivore. I'm just referencing everything all the time. It's fantastic.
Very, very referential.
I love what he does.
Yeah,
it's the same
me too.
It's the same kind of mashup as what Gondry's doing here with, you know, all the music videos he ever directed. And
that he is actually a drummer, like a very accomplished drummer.
Hmm.
He like drums on Kanye West albums.
Okay, here's the question. Does Kanye West want him to be drumming, or does he just find his way into the studio and start banging on things?
I feel like Kanye would love him.
I can see that.
Yeah, I think he would be like, oh my God, a French auteur, perfect. That's so me. That's exactly what I need.
Has he done any Kanye videos? He hasn't, has he?
No, he hasn't. I don't know if he's actually still... I think he is still directing videos.
I thought...
But he might have stopped. I don't know. I feel like he did like a White Stripes one that was really good, a Bjork one, and I don't know
yeah.
the other ones.
There's
I should
whole,
watch his
there's
videos.
A whole disc, the director series that
yeah.
the Polygram put out. It's remarkable because you get the same sense of fascination with the physical that you mm-hmm. have in Eternal Sunshine, but he's just completely unfettered by drama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of his videos are joyful mm-hmm. and weird and just loopy. And they're not, again, it's Kaufman, right? He's rooted in this remorse and despair and just this all is pain and misery kind of thing, which he then breaks through with the uplift of what is possible
mm-hmm.
At the end. And this is something that I was just, when I interviewed Noah Baumbach
mm-hmm.
about Mistress America, we had talked about his endings and how his films end, where his films end the way, where they do and why they end the way they do. And it brought up something that David Koepp said once in an interview about Ghost Town with me, with the round table thing at TIFF. He said that he doesn't like ending movies with happiness because in the films he writes, he fights against it. In the films he directs himself, he insists on it. He believes that if you end on happiness, the audience goes out bored because all their expectations have been satisfied. We're going to have a happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
If you end on the possibility of happiness, then it could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
And Ghost Town ends with, you know, it hurts when I smile. Oh, I can help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the promise of something working out. And what Eternal Sunshine does, and it's the only Kaufman script that does this, is it ends with the expectation of happiness, even though
yeah.
it might be short-lived.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be okay, but not for very long.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, honestly, the humanity of Kaufman is what gives Gondry's affectations real weight in this film, because
mm-hmm.
they would be without, if it didn't mean anything, it mm-hmm. would be just like most of his other films. It would
yeah.
be kind of style searching for a cause, for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And instead what we get is this incredible, grounded, beautiful, mournful look at possibility.
Yeah.
So the takeaway question is always the same, which is, has there been anything that you've used, mined, borrowed, stolen
I have tried to copy Kate Winslet's performance multiple times. Okay. Like, multiple. It is, like, a reference that I use. I used in, I guess most recently would have been in Gerontophilia. I tried to, yeah, totally 100% copy that. I'll be real. Like, I just steal shit all the time. But, yeah, so I have rewatched it many times with sort of that in mind. Like, okay, well, what can I use or what's really interesting here? And I think it's what I think about a lot is the way when she sings like "Oh My Darling Clementine" that movie and moves her hands like when she's also doing the piano. I've tried to do that type of thing a couple times, and I think I've used it a lot personally in my life. Like I've watched this movie like the last time I was really really heartbroken, and it gave me. I mean, it's hard to watch when you're in that place, but it gave me a certain perspective, or I guess it alleviated some of the grief and pain because I was like, well, other people feel this way too. This is something that everyone else in the world has gone through, and this is a movie that's about it. So I use it, like, I guess personally and as an artist, and I definitely want to steal other stuff from it in the future.
I was kind of hoping you were going to tell me you had different colors of hair under the bag in Rain every time.
Oh my god. No, but that was a very wigged performance. Oh my god.
Even with
that wig was hideous. Yes, I had a bald cap and a wig.
And a prosthesis,
like my burlap sack.
Yeah,
that is the weirdest job I've ever done, hands down.
The level of attention to something like that always fascinates me about television. And of course, having watched the Twitter following, people just went for it.
Yes, I'd never been involved in something that had such a online following before. Like I'd done like episodes of Lost Girl and that kind of thing that had a very real online fan base, but. Right, and also because I was on it in the first season, so I really got to watch it grow.
Right.
But, yeah, it was a trip. It was wild. All the tweets I would get, they'd be like, Clarissa, no!
Yeah.
And you'd be like, oh, God.
At what point do you say, you know, it's okay, I'm not really her, and I'm not really, you know, in that situation, everything's fine. The level of investment.
Right. I found it so, like, moving, because you also realize most of these people watching the show are 15-year-old girls.
Right.
And maybe they don't all look like Queen Mary. You know, so maybe it was nice for them to, although I don't think anyone looked like Clarissa.
I would hope.
Yeah, but it was probably nice for them to be able to relate to a character that didn't feel perfect in sort of this perfect world and that was struggling with her own identity and stuff. So I just was like, thought it was really like moving and kind of cool to see. Because also when you work in the Canadian film industry, you do so much stuff that doesn't ever land and that no one ever relates to or talks to you about. So to be able to talk about something with people who were watching it in real time, I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's true. I never really think about that. Other than Orphan Black, there really isn't a show that has that kind of rabid following in real time instant. Well, Hannibal does, but
yeah.
It doesn't even air on the same day in America
anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, and cult stuff is cult stuff. Right? Mm-hmm. By definition, people are going to flock to it. And they'll have a more vocal base, even if it doesn't have the same huge audience
as
the mainstream stuff. But it's the stuff people care about. I mean, even to bring it on back to Eternal Sunshine, this is a cult movie that happens to have, you know, it's got A-list movie stars. It's one of those things now when you look back, there is not a bad piece of casting. Every role is filled
it's
by
really
exactly
great.
The right actor for 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't, you know, someone will someday try to remake this and we will find that person and kill them because this shouldn't be tampered with.
Mm-hmm.
It's alchemy. It's the thing where everything just clicks right perfectly and it's a prized thing. I don't want anyone to ever say a bad word against it because it's too delicate and perfect.
Yeah.
And it's like a little, I hate bauble jewel analogies, but it is.
I love
like,
them, so go with it.
They built something that no one else could have built.
Yes.
And everything about it is beautiful.
Yeah.
So for the 16-year-olds who are going to find it through this podcast,
we'll
discover it because you're tweeting about it.
Yeah.
You know, how would you advise them to take it? Like, should they watch it quietly by themselves? Should they see it in a theater?
I would say try and do it how Ben and I did. Try to share it with somebody who also hasn't seen it.
Yeah.
Because then it's like something that you'll feel bonded by forever and also think about the conversation. I'm so excited for the conversation you're going to get to have after you see this movie.
Yeah, me too. The best thing about this show is finding out that people so far have seen, I went out and watched Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I'd never even heard of it.
It's like,
yeah, good for you.
That's cool. I love this podcast. I love podcasts in general, but this is a really great one, and I'm really excited for its future. I think it's, like, only going to just grow.
Thank you. I hope it takes over the world.
Everyone has a favorite movie that they would love to talk about.
Yeah, and as I keep finding out, everyone would rather talk about someone else's work than their own, because...
100%.
Yeah, it's where the fun is.
Oh my god, imagine someone picks their own movie. I hope that happens.
I think someone will try to get sneaky about it and pick something that they were sort of, oh, and I, you know, I really wanted to talk about, and then try steering the conversation into something else.
Wow.
And you can talk about your work in comparison, or as, you know, as counterpoint, but mm-hmm. come on, that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
My thanks to Katie Boland, who since recording this podcast has had a TV series greenlit by the CBC. You can find out more about that and her other work by following her on Twitter at Katie Boland, which is all one word. And check out her web series Long Story Short at longstoryshort.com. It's pretty sharp, and it also features friend of the show Tommy Amber-Peary, so that's neat. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is available on Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment, and in Canada it's available under the Alliance label, but it's the same disc. You can also rent or buy it on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, I promise I'll remember that. Thanks for listening.